Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I remember the name of the program. I maybe forgot it for a second there, but welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Tim Staples is our guest, and the reason I got crossed up was I was so impressed with your big giant name on the screen there. Tim Staples, senior apologist. Yeah. But thanks for coming back for another hour.
It's great to be back, man, because 1 hour is not enough time.
It's definitely not enough time. No, I totally agree with that. I'm always happy when you're here for 2 hours. But I'm going to warn you like 15 minutes before the show ends that sure. Tim, there's like 15 minutes left. Okay. Relax.
So I'm not devastated when I finally say, that'll be helpful.
Yeah, I don't want you to be devastated. Right. The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Tim, apropos of nothing, I just want to ask you a quick movie question. Did you love the movie The Planet of the Apes when you were a kid?
I did.
I loved that movie too.
Yeah. Talking about the real one with Charlton Heston?
Yeah. Right. Not his best movie. His best movie, of course, the one that you...
Yes.
Ten Commandments.
The Ten Commandments. Oh, he was born for that role. He was a better Moses than Moses was Moses.
Moses was probably like, oh, come on, man. I could never do it that well.
Because, of course, Moses stuttered, right?
You know, that's right. Moses stuttered, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. 888-318-7884 is the number. Lots of folks have been on the line quite a long time. So
yes.
I am going to get right back to the phones. We'll go to Oro Valley, Arizona. Meg, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Meg, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Tim.
Hi,
Meg.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to Tim Staples.
Hey, all right.
Okay.
I'm excited to talk to you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. You've been responsible for kind of me growing in my knowledge of the Bible. You've kind of kick-started me in
Beautiful.
A lot of ways. And so I find myself and my husband, and we are leading a Bible study at our parish, and we're going through one of the materials from Ascension Press, and the commentator with the video that's attributed with it was starting to talk about the birthright and the blessing of the firstborn.
Gotcha.
And kind of protocol around those two things.
Right.
So that's kind of the premise of my question.
Okay.
Is very specifically to the story of Joseph. This is what, maybe Joseph, yes.
Yes.
Like Jacob, Joseph, Judah.
Okay? Got it.
And so the question that came up in the study is that typically we've seen the birthright and the blessing, the father's blessing, go to the same individual.
Normally, yes.
And it was hinted at in Esau and Jacob that it could potentially be two separate entities.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jeff Cavins explicitly talked about the fact that Joseph received the double portion given to those that received the birthright.
Yes.
And yet Judah received the blessing.
Yes.
And so it got divided. That was the first example we had found that where it had been divided between two.
Right.
And so I wanted to know if our assumption that it usually goes to the same person is correct, if there was anything to do with the fact that he was playing politics with his women. Leah and Rachel.
Right.
And if there's any biblical significance to it being separated,
right.
So on.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a really great question. You're causing me to rack my brain here. This is fun stuff. But I think the key, you are correct, and Jeff Cavins, as usual, he's a tremendous Bible teacher. He is correct. Generally, both the blessing of the firstborn and the blessing, the double blessing, go to the firstborn, and that's rooted all the way back in Exodus 13:2, right? That the firstborn receives the blessing. However, what's unveiled throughout the Old Testament is that, as usual, God is God and we are not, and so God can give blessings to whom He wills. And so, yes, these blessings can, in fact, be divided up. And what's fascinating here is that with the sons of Joseph, Reuben would be the firstborn, right? If memory serves.
Yeah,
Reuben would be the firstborn. But, of course, my take is that it's because Leah was Jacob's intended wife. He had to work those extra 7 years to get to his beloved Rachel. He had to marry Leah, but that was his intended, that was his beloved. And of course, there's symbolism, as Jeff Cavins would point out as well, of Israel versus the church, right? We receive the blessing of the firstborn, even though our predecessors, Israel, are the firstborn chronologically. So all of this becomes very important for the fullness of the new covenant, where all of this typology really makes sense and you see it in full. And so I would argue it's because with Jacob, it's not so much politics as that Rachel was his beloved. He was the one, you know, he was laboring for her and such. And so that Joseph then receives the blessing. And remember, Jacob then adopts Manasseh and Ephraim too. And they receive a double blessing through Joseph and being adopted by Jacob. And so and you can get into his First Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1 tells you why Reuben, it goes a little deeper and tells you Reuben didn't receive the blessing of the firstborn because he committed adultery and such. And of course, God knows beforehand, and all of that is worked out. So I think that's what you get, biblically speaking, why the blessing is divided up. Now, as far as Judah receiving the blessing, as I recall, I don't recall any text in the Old Testament that gives a reason, like with Reuben, you know, committing adultery and whatnot, why. I believe it's just the divine prerogative. Judah was called to be the leader among the sons, and so he would be the son that the Messiah would come from. He would be the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So Judah... His name, in fact, means praise, and he becomes an object of praise among his brethren and the source of the blessing of the Messiah. But I think that's just the divine prerogative. God, gives gifts to whom he will give, to use the Pauline principle there in Romans chapter 12, right? God gives gifts to whom he will. And at times, God tells us the why. He'll give us the hint, yeah, Reuben committed adultery and such. And sometimes, it's just, guess what? I'm choosing him,
yeah, right?
At any rate, it's a great question, and probably a guy like Jeff Cavins might be the one to ask because he knows the Old Testament a lot better than I do.
Thanks, Meg.
Thank you.
All right. God bless.
Let's go to Robert in Pennsylvania.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. We'll go to Robert in Pennsylvania, listening on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. Robert, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Tim.
Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. I'd like to know, is it a sin if you viewed photographs of women wearing bikinis or, like, revealing clothing, but there's no nudity involved?
Right. Well, I don't think you can give a definitive yes or no to that because... you know, there are different contexts. So that would be up to the individual in this sense, that if you have somebody who's working in designing bathing suits and whatnot, and they're looking at them and so forth, that would be very different than a person who's looking lustfully at women in those bikinis. So I think the key is, are you looking, and really, I mean, you can lust after a woman in a bikini or in a nice dress, you know? So if you're looking at a woman, and that's the key, isn't it? As an object, and you allow lust to rise up in your heart to where you're committing adultery with them. And that's Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, verse 28 and 29. If you lust after a woman in your heart, you've already committed adultery with her. So that's the key. And I always go back to James 1:15 as well. Lust, when it is conceived in the heart, brings forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. So are you lusting? I'm not saying you personally, but the person looking at those pictures, are you looking at a woman as a sexual object? Well, then you are in danger. You need to flee from that temptation and stop looking. Does that make sense?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right,
my next part of my that question was going to be like, okay, so now we're talking about men, but I think you clarified this. What happens if a woman was, you know, on, say, Pinterest, and you're just looking at, you know, women in bikinis and stuff like that?
Right, right. Well,
but
I
infer from what you're saying, the same would apply.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's unfortunate that our culture has fallen so far that we have women in bikinis at all. I mean, to me, it is just insane that we have women in bikinis. I'm sorry, I'm old-fashioned here, Psychelet, but it's insane. You know, when it first started back in what, that would have been late 50s?
In the 50s.
And then in the 60s, I mean, people were just shocked and horrified. What are you, you're running around in your underwear here. What's going on here? And now we've become so desensitized to it. While I still hold to that principle that theoretically it's possible somebody can look at a woman in a bikini for reasons other than making them an object and so forth. But men, let's get real. Okay, you don't look at women in bikinis, all right? I mean, you're opening up custody of the senses. Look away, all right? But God bless you, and thanks for the question.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks very, very much. That brings us to the break. We'll take a very quick break and be right back with more questions. It's open forum. Tim Staples is our guest on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Tim Staples, our guest both hours. So we've been having lots of fun. And if you have a question about the Catholic faith, maybe a question about Jesus, maybe a question about the Bible, or maybe it's a more generally religious question, you still have time to get in the queue before the end of this hour. So if you'd like to do that, the number's 888-318-7884. Going to Washington now. Jason, watching on YouTube. Jason, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Tim.
Hi, yes, thank you. So I kind of have a two-part question that stemmed out of a conversation I had with my wife. Just background, I converted to the Catholic Church 3 years ago, and she's a cradle Catholic, so
praise God.
Fun conversations.
Welcome home, brother.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
My question specifically is about the rosary.
Yes.
And I guess kind of the context to my question is I was saying a chaplet, St. Michael, and my wife made a comment on how you should pray the rosary before you pray any other prayers. So that's kind of my first question, is there basis behind that, or, you know, is there a hierarchy kind of you should always start with the rosary before saying other kind of devotional prayers?
Right. Okay. Well, first, let me jump in there. It's not like there's a hierarchical structure. You can have different prayer groups that will pray different prayers, but there is a general structure, rosary, and then certain prayers that follow, and these are what we call traditions with a small t, but these are not, you know, we have to make distinctions between things that are doctrinal and things that are matters of practice. And so, you know, there are actually different forms of prayers where different prayers will be located in different places. So there's not a strict hierarchy when it comes to these things. So, You know, we'd have to get into, you know, the particular prayers and why this is before that. But, you know, as long as we're not dogmatic about it, you know, you just kind of go with the flow. Go with the flow of if you're praying with a particular prayer group, they usually have their prayers set that they do, and you go with it. And it's a blessing. That's the way I look at it.
Awesome. Thank you. If I can use my second question real quick. And that was around praying the rosary when you're not really able to focus on the actual mysteries of the rosary, and your mind starts wandering, but you're still saying the words. And to me, that, you know, like, the verge is on the praying with vain repetition.
Gotcha.
Where you're
I'm
not
in trouble then.
Focused on that at all. It's almost like you're just saying the words just to say the words at that point.
All right, Jason.
Right.
I have an answer here for you. Go ahead.
Yeah, that is a really important question. Thank you for asking that, because I know that was a question I had when I first converted 30 years ago. I had all kinds of, you know, I just wanted to know I was doing it right. So am I doing this wrong? Can you help me? But here is the key. Always, when you talk about vain repetition, always refer back to Matthew 6, verse 7. Look at what Jesus actually said. He said, pray not. And the Greek verb there is batalageo. Doesn't that sound like, you know, babble kind of? Batalageo, right? And that's what it is. It's a babbling. Pray not vain repetition as the heathens. And here's the key. Who think they will be heard for their much speaking. Right? And that's a key to understanding vain repetition. You think because, okay, I got to do, right? I have to do this many in order to be heard. That's vain repetition, right? And remember, this is in the context of what? The pagans. He says, as the heathens or the pagans, who remember, they had, I always think at this in this context of St. Paul on Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17. Remember when he goes up there and you can picture all of those shrines and altars to all the different gods. And people would literally go around and offer sacrifices to all these different gods and do their incantations. But remember this too. People forget this. You weren't necessarily, I mean, there were good pious Romans that, you know, there was a true piety there. But for most of the average folks, they're appeasing these gods to get them out of their life. It wasn't a thing where I want the gods at my house. I mean, these gods will kill you. They kill each other. They fight with each other. They're not exactly the guys you want to have at dinner. So it was kind of a, you know, you're saying all these prayers to get it done, for many of them, to get the gods out of your life. But the point being, you get your incantations done and you've done it, right? That is what Jesus is saying. That is vain repetitions. It's not saying our Father multiple times and a Hail Mary. It's not saying, and I use the image, Jason, of I love you. I guarantee you can ask my wife. She has never told me, Tim, would you stop saying I love you? You have said it already five times today. Knock it off, right? I've never had my wife do that, right? Because when we're talking about the Our Father and the Hail Mary, these are perfect prayers. They're biblical. In fact, the Our Father is what Jesus told us to pray, and he did not mean pray it once, right? In fact, he himself, when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, he prayed for hours, and the scripture says he prayed over and over again, not my will, but thy will be done. He prayed that for hours, not just 1 hour. There was actually multiple hours, right? So the vain repetition is the key, not repetition. And I'm sure you know this, Psalm 118, Psalm 136, his mercy endures forever. His love endures forever, right? Over and over and over again in those texts. We have the angels in Revelation chapter 4, verse 8 that are praying, holy, holy, holy. And we know they've been praying at least 800 years because you go back to Isaiah chapter 6, same angels, and guess what they're doing? The same prayer. Holy, holy, holy. That's where we get the Sanctus from in the Mass, right? We're joining the angels and saints in praying. Holy, holy, holy. The angels have been doing that for eons and eons of time. And so don't worry, my friend. And this isn't just for you, but this is for everyone listening. Do not worry. Oh, I'm praying the rosary, but I'm falling off here and I'm just mouthing. It seems like I'm mouthing the words. Guess what? Keep saying those words. Yes, you will at times be more intensive than others, but you continue. And by the way, don't stop saying you love your wife because you don't feel warm and fuzzy today, right? You say the words, I love you, I love you. And you know what happens when you say these prayers? You remember, Cy, we've talked about this before, when you memorize something, right? What happens? You know it by heart. Because when you know something and you recite it, you know what happens is it sinks down into your heart over time, right? I think I'll leave you with this thought, my friend. There's a real danger. There's a danger on, but there's two extremes. I mean, you can have the extreme of thinking, yeah, I'm going to just say the rosary and mouth the words, and because I say it, I'm going to be blessed. Yeah, that's vain repetition. But at the same time, you can go the other way that says, unless I feel on the top of the mountain and I'm just, wow, fervent and tears in my eyes, then I'm not going to pray. And that is dangerous to the spiritual life. That's dangerous to any relationship, because whether you feel great or not, you're married. Right? You're married to Missy, by the way. You know that.
I do know that. Okay. I'm aware of that. Things slipped my mind, but that hasn't yet.
That's right. And so, you know, you act like it, right? Because you're in a relationship, you act like it, whether you feel like it or not. And the feelings come and the feelings go. And the same with our relationship with God. Feelings will come and feelings will go, but He is worthy of our worship. He's worthy of our prayers. And so there's a sense in which we do it. We say the prayers for that reason, because it's the virtue of religion, right? That we say these beautiful words to our God, whom we love, whether we feel it or not. And then it's amazing what happens, because when you do that out of commitment to our Blessed Lord, to our Blessed Lady, and you just do it, and then all of a sudden, you know what happens? You do feel it, right? You do feel it at times, and you know, and it's like, wow, and you're the better for it. I'm trying to, you know, avoid the two extremes, and I think for most of us that are not, you know, saints floating around in our living rooms and whatnot, prayer is a struggle.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that's life. Life is a struggle. Relationships are a struggle, and so is our relationship with God. So pray without ceasing, as St. Paul says, whether you feel it or not. Does that make sense?
Totally. Thank you.
All right, brother. God bless you.
Thanks, Jason. Let's go to James in the Philippines, in Manila, watching on YouTube. Is this a new? I'm sure there are many James in the Philippines, but we used to have a friend, James, who would call from time to time in the Philippines. Same James or different?
Very same James, yeah.
Well, welcome back, James. I don't know what you've been doing. You think you can just come back here without any explanation? All right, I guess you can.
Yes, I've been busy with work.
All right, we'll take that explanation. Yeah, go ahead with your question for Tim. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I'm so excited to talk to Tim Saples.
All right, brother.
So
thanks, James.
Hey, let me ask you something, James. Did I meet you when I was in the Philippines or no?
I would hope so, but I don't think so.
Don't think so. Okay, well, I hope to come back there. I absolutely love the Philippines. But what's on your mind, brother?
Hopefully. Yeah, so I'm trying to understand the limits of praying to the saints. Now, I do understand that they're more alive than we are now, and they do hear our prayers, but would asking them about the future count as necromancy? So asking St. Joseph to help you with school or work, that's okay, that's cool.
Yes.
But asking St. Joseph to, say, tell you what the winning Powerball combinations are, would that be necromancy?
Right. Now, no, it's not. Necromancy is to manipulate the spiritual realm through the use of incantations, going to witches, seances, and that sort of thing. If you read Deuteronomy 18, verse 10, for example, it explicitly says that. It's the attempt to manipulate the spiritual realm for your own purpose through illicit means. Now, what you're talking about, asking saints about something that's going to happen in the future, is just unwise. You know, you're not attempting necromancy because you're not attempting to employ some force to manipulate the future. It's just unwise. You don't ask the saints to tell you what's going to happen in the future because Jesus tells us, don't think about the future. You don't think about the past so much because it's the past. It's gone. You don't think about the future because it hasn't happened yet. Jesus says, sufficient to the day is the evil thereof. Focus here. That's what Jesus says.
Thanks, James. Right back with more Open Forum. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Johnette Williams. We embrace the essence of feminine spirituality on Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are a half hour away from Tim being shocked that the show is over, but I'm going to continue to give him warnings between now and that time.
I've been warned.
Tim Staples, our guest. It's Open Forum. It really is nice to have you here for 2 hours, Tim.
Oh,
I know
I
we
love
don't get
it.
To do that a lot, but it's very nice to have you here for 2 hours. Sandy in Prince Springs, New York is next, listening on 89.9 FM. Sandy, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Tim.
Hi. I was wondering, when you're an extraordinary minister and you administer the Eucharist, and once in a while somebody will ask for an intincture and you're supposed to say no, I do, and I agree with it, but I don't know why. Because
right.
They do that in other Eastern Catholic
right.
churches and stuff.
Right. Yeah, and I think it all goes back to the distinction between the ordained ministry and the non-ordained. Number one, and number two, I should put that as number two. Number one, it's really all about protecting the Blessed Sacrament. Because I know, and we know here at Catholic Answers, we used to do by intinction fairly regularly, there can be real problems with spillage, you know, dripping the precious blood and whatnot. So a lot of it really is centuries of practical learning by Holy Mother Church, you know, that this is not a good idea. But it does get at also the idea of ordinary versus extraordinary ministers and drawing that line, you know, that it is the minister's role to be the minister. And, you know, I don't know if you remember this, Sandy, but when Pope St. John Paul was reigning, he gave a directive, and I can't remember the document now. Maybe you'll remember, Cy, but he ordered the church in any place where there were extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion. He said we had to make one of the intentions of the Mass that we would have enough ordinary ministers that we wouldn't need extraordinary ministers.
Oh, yeah.
I will never forget that. It didn't last that long and such, but I just remember that. And there's a reason for that, right? You really don't want extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion. The reason why we have extraordinary ministers is because there's not enough ordinary ministers.
Right, right.
And so I do think that's part of the puzzle, Sandy, that, you know, to make the distinction between the ordinary ministers who are trained, and some of them, of course, have holy orders and such, versus the extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion who don't have that same level of training and whatnot. But all of it, I think I'm safe to say, Cy, all of it revolves around protecting the sacredness of the Blessed Sacrament. And I think that's ultimately what the law is for.
Sandy, I'm getting kind of into the go fast rounds now because there's lots of people on the line, so I will leave that there. I hope that was helpful to you. And let me just figure out where I'm going next. I am going to Australia. All right. Gerard in Australia, watching on YouTube. That's really far away. Gerard, we're glad you're here. Where are you in Australia, Gerard?
Yeah, Aiden. Good morning.
Good morning. What's tomorrow like?
Yes. Sorry.
Never mind. I'm just messing around, Gerard.
how's tomorrow? He was saying.
So far, so good.
We can't hear you very well, though, Gerard. So if you could speak right into the phone, it's one of those Australian phones.
Yes. Hello. Yeah, I have a question regarding the churches.
Yes.
That was Jesus instruct John of Patmos to the seven churches.
Yes.
And with regards to the churches which Jesus established, the Catholic Church.
Yes.
I'm just confused. If Jesus established his church, why he instructed these seven churches to John of Patmos?
Sure. Yeah, great question. And the simple answer is that John, we know, was in Ephesus. Right, so he was the apostle, the bishop of Ephesus, which is one of the seven churches, and he would have had a lot of dealings with those seven churches of Asia Minor. And so Jesus reveals all of this for John in the context of those seven churches, but knowing that this would become, it's kind of like, you know, John, when he writes his pastoral letters of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, most likely they too were written initially not as universal sort, what they became, pastoral letters to the universal church. They were most likely, I argue anyway, they were most likely originally either to Ephesus or to the surrounding churches, because that's who John was most, you know, he was closest to. St. Paul, when he wrote his letters, he wrote letters to churches that he either visited or he was going to visit, right? So that's the simple answer. But of course, Jesus uses, now once you understand that, because right from the beginning in Revelation chapter 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place, and he made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ. And then in verse 4, John to the seven churches that are in Asia Minor. So just like with the three epistles, they're originally sent to those churches, but then they become letters to the universal church. If you look at Paul's letters, same thing. Letter to the Romans, to the Corinthians, and so forth, or a pastoral letter written to Timothy or to Titus, Right. So it's kind of the MO as to how the scriptures are written. But if you go to the book of Acts, I think what you might be getting at, if you look at the way the churches, some of these very same churches like Ephesus here, they are mentioned as churches that Paul goes to in Acts chapter 18, Acts chapter 19, and such. All of these churches, though, have to be in submission to the church headed by St. Peter. And that's what you see at the Council of Jerusalem when there were problems in various of these churches, and then they have the first council. You have Peter at the helm. He declares the truth. James then, along with the other apostles, send a letter to the troubled churches, and that's how the church has functioned for 2,000 years. Does that make sense, brother?
Okay. So in this sense, these churches are in union with Jesus Christ now.
That's right. They are in union with Jesus Christ and his vicar, that is Peter, and of course his successors, which are the bishops of Rome.
Thank you so much.
All right, brother.
Thank you, Gerard.
God bless you.
It's a real pleasure to get to speak to you down under there. I hope you do have a good day. I'm going to go to Joy in Kansas now, watching on YouTube. Hi, Joy.
Hi, good evening, Cy and Tim.
Good evening. Go ahead with your question for Tim.
Okay, so I volunteer to teach little kids catechism. And I just need a little bit of help, Tim, if you can please help me. How do you explain grace to First Communion kids?
Right. I explain it the way I've explained it to my kids, all seven of them, and I'm working on Mary right now because she's six. She's getting there. She's the last one, you know. But anyway, I like to explain it as a power pill, right? Jesus gives us a power pill to transform us into supernatural people. See, we're all natural people. Cy Kellett's a natural dude going about our work, but Jesus comes on the scene and he wants to make us supernatural people, to empower us to do supernatural stuff. That is to love people even when they're unlovable, right? To go out into this world and be examples of Jesus Christ to the world. These are things that we can't do by our own strength. So guess what? Jesus gives us a power pill. It's called the Eucharist. And what the Eucharist is by a miracle of grace, when Father says, this is my body, it becomes the body, blood, soul, and divinity of the Lord. And Jesus gives us this great gift because he wants to give us this power pill that's more than just a pill, it's himself. That power pill is Jesus himself who comes inside of us. And for those 10 minutes, when, you know, before the accidents or the appearances of bread and wine breakdown, Jesus is present in his physical reality. As Pope St. Paul VI said it in his masterpiece of 1965, Mysterium Fidei, he says that his physical reality, the substantial presence, yes, but a physical reality inside, so that graces and power, and that's where you can use the power pill analogy, right?
Yeah.
That power pill that is Jesus himself communicates power to us in a unique way that can't be done any other way. You are receiving an incredible gift here to transform you from the inside out. But that's basically what I do.
Wow, that's very nice. I'm going to use that. Thank you very much.
Cool. All right. Let me know how it works.
We're always grateful to talk to somebody who shares the faith with children. So maybe there's a book that we can send you. If you know of a Catholic Answers book that you want, Joy, just hang on and we'll put Edgar on the line with you, and Edgar will get you that book. And if you don't know which book you want, then how about, I'm trying to think of what, because she teaches kids, I'm thinking what would be a good one.
How about our 20 Answers on the Eucharist?
Okay, 20 Answers on the Eucharist.
Yeah.
But you can have anyone you want. I just wanted to suggest one in case you didn't know.
Yes.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Right back with the final segment of Catholic Answers Live. Tim, I'm saying that to you, the final segment when we come back.
I refuse to believe it.
All right, we'll be right back. Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because it is the food of the saints that we receive. And for the saints, they understood rightly that the time after Holy Communion, that those moments are the most precious moments of our lives.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Tim Staples, our guest. I think Joy took a book, but I don't know what book she took, so I'm super curious to find out. Anybody in there? Oh, they're all busy. The number here is, I don't know if I should. Yeah, there's probably time to get at least one on. 888-3187-884-888-31-TRUTH. Open forum means open to anybody on any question, and we're going to Utah next. Nancy in Utah, watching on YouTube. Nancy, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Tim.
I am here, and you are there.
I think I agree with that. I don't think I can challenge you on any of that.
I know I'm here, and it's very cold.
not here, Nancy. It's delightful
yes,
here.
I have an Infant of Prague figurine that's about almost 12 inches tall that was my grandmother's. It's made out of china. It lights up. I bring it out every year at Christmas.
I love the Infant of Prague.
I asked one woman that I barely know, what do you think the symbology is of what the hands are doing?
Right.
And apparently the right hand, which has the first two fingers extended, and a gold band around them, she compared to some couple of names that you find in the tarot cards. I've got them written down, but it's nonsense to me.
Uh-oh.
So, and then the other hand, of course, has what looks like a globe with a cross on it. Do you know what those mean, actually?
Yes. And by the way, this was one of Pope St. John Paul the Great's favorite devotions, the Infant of Prague, and I absolutely love it for reasons I shall share in a moment. But basically, the right hand is raised in blessing with the two fingers reflecting his hypostatic union, that is, the divine and human nature. And the other three fingers that you mentioned are raised to symbolize the unity of the Blessed Trinity. So it's basically the Trinity and the hypostatic union that's being symbolized here. As far as the hands go. But what, if I may, because I love the Infant of Prague, what we have to remember is the Infant of Prague is not actually a little dude, you know, running around like a 8-year-old or something like that. It's actually an infant. And so an infant meaning that even though he has not reached the age of accountability, he still, because of the fact that he has the beatific vision and the hypostatic union, he is God. He just happens to be upholding the entire universe as a little baby, as a little infant. And this is the foundation, as Pope John Paul the Great taught, for us having a devotion to Christ in the womb, because he was saving the world in the womb. He was saving the world as an infant. When I first learned that a zillion years ago, that lit me up. As I will tell you, as a former Protestant, you know, we just didn't have that kind of Christology, you know, but it just so blew my mind that, man, we can have a devotion to Jesus in the womb because Jesus was saving us. He had the beatific vision in the womb, and as an infant, he was saving the world. To me, that's one of the most beautiful things about the Infant of Prague. Now, of course, the hand raised in blessing, reflecting the hypostatic union, and the three fingers reflecting the Blessed Trinity are crucial as well, because, of course, that's the you know, what is the principal mystery of the of our Catholic Christian faith, but the Trinity. And of course, in the in the hierarchy of truths, the Catholic Church teaches that the first and greatest truth is the Trinity and a Christocentric understanding of the Blessed Trinity. So all of that is incorporated into the Infant of Prague.
Okay. I really appreciate that. That is great.
All right.
Then I'm going to watch your reruns on YouTube, so right. It really sinks into my head. One more thing about it. I've had a little bitty plastic one since I've been a teenager, and I was told if you keep money, a coin under it, and have it facing the door, you will never go broke.
Okay.
That's not true.
Huh? No, I wouldn't count on that. Let's put it that way, Si. Now, Si, is this something you practice?
No. I was looking at Darren because he lit up. And I have you heard of this before, Darren? Or no, this was a new one. It okay. sounds I don't want to use a harsh word, but it sounds like a superstitious to
yeah.
me.
Yeah, and we do have to.
I always thought so, but I'm yeah. going to take the quarter out from underneath it and put it in my wallet.
Yeah,
well, you'll be 25 cent less broke then. All yeah, right.
But just as a point of teaching,
well,
as
I used to have a 50 cent piece under it, but yeah. it disappeared once. I think one of the kids must have needed it.
As a point of teaching, though, if you look at the Catechism section, and I want to say 2111, 2112. The Catechism has a wonderful little section on superstition, which is basically the belief that you can perform an action, even a pious action, and it will have an effect apart from the necessary spiritual dispositions that must be present. That is the definition of superstition. And so these ideas, you know, putting statues upside down and quarters facing in the direction and stuff, those kinds of things are to be avoided because they do border on, if not fall into, superstition.
Thanks, Nancy. I'm going to keep going because I got two more folks I would love to get on with Tim before we have to go. So I will say excuse me and move on. Missy in Kentucky listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. We have a pretty good friend, Missy in Kentucky. Is this the same?
This is the same one.
Hi, Missy. Welcome back. There's not a lot of time, though, so we're good. I better get you right to your question, though.
Let's get to it then.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So in 2 Samuel 6, I think in 7.
Yes.
There's this fun fact that, well, not so fun, but that, you know, the guy.
Uzzah. His name was Uzzah.
Reaches over, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That he reaches over and he tries to do a great thing, but it's not. And he accidentally, you know, he dies because the God gets mad. Is there any possible way that this could have been included to tell us what may have happened to St. Joseph? And I sure hope I'm not asking this, and no disrespect to St. Joseph,
yes,
protector of the Holy Family, but just want to know if there was a reason that was there.
Yes, Missy, you're right. There is a reason why that was there, and it was all about showing us the holiness of Jesus and the holiness of the Blessed Mother. Because, of course, the reason why Uzzah could not touch the ark was because of what was inside of the ark. The Ten Commandments, or the Ten Words in Hebrew, right? The Ten Dabar, the Aaron's rod that budded, and a sample of the miraculous manna, which were all types of Jesus, by the way. But it's because of those sacred objects that the ark that contained them was so holy that even though Uzzah was a Kohathite, he was a Levitical priest, but a particular Levitical priest known as the, you can read about them in Numbers chapter 4, the Kohathites who were called to carry the ark, and they could not touch it. They had to put these golden staves. They were actually made of acacia wood, but they were overlain with gold, and they went through these rings on both sides of the ark, and they had to put the staves through those rings and carry the ark without touching it, right? So when Uzzah and his brother, Ahio, and there was one other brother, they weren't doing their job. They were carrying the ark up to Jerusalem, and it is a journey. You got to go up. And they got tired, and they put the ark up on some oxen. And God didn't say that ox could carry it. The Kohathites were supposed to carry it, right? They weren't doing their job. And as they were walking up and their shoulders were rolling, you could see the ark almost falls. And it's about to fall to the ground, and Uzzah thinks he's going to save the day. He saves the ark from falling. But Remember this. God didn't say the ark couldn't touch the ground. He said man could not touch it. So when Uzzah touched it, he was killed. And again, to show the holiness of not just those sacred objects inside and that wooden box overlain with gold, but what they typified, Jesus and the Blessed Mother. So I say all that to say this. I believe that Joseph would have known who it is that he was living with. Now, this does not mean he could not physically touch her. No. But there's a what's being symbolically revealed here is both Mary's Immaculate Conception and her perpetual virginity. So he would have known full and well that he could not touch her in a conjugal way. You better believe it. If anyone attempted to touch the Blessed Mother in that way, they would be dead. All right, that's just Tim Stables' opinion. You're not going to get a magisterial teaching on that, Cy Kellett,
yeah,
but that is
right.
What I believe. And it's a beautiful image, of course, that reveals to us the fact that Mary is the Immaculate Conception and perpetual virgin. But God bless you. Thanks for your question.
Missy, I'm going to keep moving because, as I said, I got a couple folks on the line, and I do want to try to get everybody on. But thank you very much for the call. It's nice to talk with you again. Now we are going to John in Illinois, listening on 88.9 FM. John, thank you for your call. Just a few minutes left, so if you could be kind of quick with your question, Tim will be able to get you an answer.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, and that was actually a really good question before mine. Mine regards the second commandment. Considering the prevalence of God's name being used in vain these days, like in movies, any conversation, and that it also that it comes before so many other commandments. What can you say about the severity of God's name being used in general? Especially in movies these days.
Oh, my goodness. John, we could do a whole hour on this. Let me say a couple of things. Yeah, the second commandment is run over every minute of every day in the United States of America and around the world, but that doesn't mean it's still not there. It is. Taking the Lord's name in vain has a plethora of meanings, but number one, you don't just use our blessed Lord's name to no avail. As a punchline, as just using, you know, I don't even want to say the letters, you know, I'm using our blessed Lord's name other than in the context of a loving and respectful mentioning of his name is it should break our hearts. But let's go beyond that. Not so to me, and I'm sorry, I know people get mad at me, but I'm sorry, Father Stu. Knock it off. You don't need to do that. I know people get mad at me. You don't have to have every, but it's realism, man. It's truth. This is what he said. I don't care. You don't need to say that stuff so that my kids can't go see a movie like this. You know, I mean, it's just, it's wrong to take the Lord's name in vain. Take a lesson from Alfred Hitchcock, okay? Take a lesson from the great Frank Capra. They didn't have to use the Lord's name in vain in order to communicate that people were doing bad things, okay? And I know somebody's going to get mad at me for saying that, and frankly, I don't care because I hear it all the time, and I'm still going to say it because it's just wrong. You don't need to do that kind of stuff, and let's go beyond that. Another way you can use the Lord's name in vain is when you are a teacher in a Catholic school and you don't teach Catholic theology. Another way you can use the Lord's name in vain, you can be a cardinal in the Catholic Church and say homosexual relationships are fine, you know, or can be fine, or possibly can be fine. You can be a bishop. You can be a member of the Flemish bishops or the German bishops, and you can talk about blessing so-called homosexual unions. That is taking the Lord's name in vain. That is blasphemy. That is another way that we can take the Lord's name in vain. We as Catholics need to stand up for the truth of our Catholic faith because that's standing up for the name of Jesus.
John, thanks. Fired Tim up here at the end of the show. Amen. Appreciate that. A great question. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody. And we got through everybody.
Amen, brother.
All the Earth's questions were answered today. That's great. Thank you very much, Tim.
All right, brother. God bless you.
I look forward to seeing you later in the week. And tomorrow, Carlo, right? We got Carlo? All right, Carlo Broussard tomorrow. Catholic Answers Live. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic. Now I said it twice. Yeah, that didn't work. I'm just going to say it anyways. See you tomorrow, God willing, Catholic Answers Live.